amygdala, which operates subconsciously, and our rational thinking, most importantly controlled by our prefrontal cortex, which operates consciously. If you understand how those battles occur, you will understand why it is so important to reconcile what you get from your subconscious with what you get from your conscious mind. That damned amygdala, which is a little almond-shaped structure that lies deeply embedded in the cerebrum, is one of the most powerful parts of your brain. It controls your behavior, even though you're not conscious of it. How does it work? When something upsets us, and that something could be a sound, a sight, or just a gut feeling, the amygdala sends notice to our bodies to prepare to fight or flee. The heartbeat speeds up, the blood pressure rises, and breathing quickens. During an argument, you'll often notice a physical response similar to how you react to fear, for instance, rapid heartbeats and tensing muscles. Recognizing that your conscious mind, which resides in the prefrontal cortex, can refuse to obey its instructions. Typically, these amygdala hijackings come on fast and dissipate quickly, except in rare cases such as when a person develops post-traumatic stress disorder from a particularly horrible event or series of events. Knowing how these hijackings work, you know that if you allow yourself to react spontaneously, you will be prone to overreact. You can also comfort yourself with the knowledge that whatever psychological pain you are experiencing will go away before very long. C. Reconcile your feelings and your thinking. For most people, life is a never-ending battle between these two parts of the brain. While the amygdala's reactions come in spurts and then subside, reactions from the prefrontal cortex are more gradual and constant. The biggest difference between people who guide their own personal evolution and achieve their goals and those who don't is that those who make progress reflect on what causes their amygdala hijackings. D. Choose your habits well. Habit is probably the most powerful tool in your brain's toolbox. It is driven by a golf ball-sized lump of tissue called the basal ganglia at the base of the cerebrum. It is so deep-seated and instinctual that we are not conscious of it, though it controls our actions. If you do just about anything frequently enough over time, you will form a habit that will control you. Good habits are those that get you to do what your upper-level you wants, and bad habits are those that are controlled by your lower-level you and stand in the way of your getting what your upper-level you wants. You can create a better set of habits if you understand how this part of your brain works. For example, you can develop a habit that will make you need to work out at the gym. Developing this skill takes some work. The first step is recognizing how habits develop in the first place. Habit is essentially inertia, the strong tendency to keep doing what you have been doing or not doing what you have not been doing. Research suggests that if you stick with a behavior for approximately 18 months, you will build a strong tendency to stick to it nearly forever. For a long time, I didn't appreciate the extent to which habits control people's behavior. I experienced this at Bridgewater in the form of people who agreed with our work principles in the abstract, but had trouble living by them. I also observed it with friends and family members who wanted to achieve something but constantly found themselves working against their own best interests. Then I read Charles Duhigg's best-selling book, The Power of Habit, which really opened my eyes. I recommend that you read it yourself if your interest in this subject goes deeper than what I'm able to cover here. Duhigg's core idea is the role of the three-step habit loop. The first step is a cue, some trigger that tells your brain to go into automatic mode and which habit to use, according to Duhigg. Step two is the routine, which can be physical or mental or emotional. Finally, there is a reward which helps your brain figure out if this particular loop is worth remembering for the future. Repetition reinforces this loop until over time it becomes automatic. This anticipation and craving is the key to what animal trainers call operant conditioning, which is a method of training that uses positive reinforcement. For example, dog trainers use a sound, typically a clicker, to reinforce behavior by pairing that sound with a more desirable reward, typically food, until the dog will perform the desired behavior when it merely hears the click. In humans, Duhigg says, rewards can be just about anything, ranging from food or drugs that cause physical sensations to emotional payoffs such as the feelings of pride that accompany praise or self-congratulation. Habits put your brain on automatic pilot. In neuroscientific terms, the basal ganglia takes over from your cortex so that you can execute activities without even thinking about them. Reading Duhigg's book taught me that if you really want to change, the best thing you can do is choose which habits to acquire and which to get rid of, and then go about doing that. To help you, I recommend that you write down your three most harmful habits. Do that right now. Now, pick one of those habits and be committed to breaking it. Can you do that? That would be extraordinarily impactful. If you break all three, you will radically improve the trajectory of your life. Or you can pick habits that you want to acquire and then acquire them. The most valuable habit I've acquired is using pain to trigger quality reflections. If you can acquire this habit yourself, you will learn what causes your pain and what you can do about it, and it will have an enormous impact on your effectiveness. E. Train your lower level you with kindness and persistence to build the right habits. I used to think that the upper level you needed to fight with the lower level you to gain control, but over time, I've learned that it is more effective to train that subconscious emotional you the same way you would teach a child to behave the way you would like him or her to behave, with loving kindness and persistence, so that the right habits are acquired. F. Understand the differences between right-brained and left-brained thinking. Just as your brain has its conscious upper part and its subconscious lower part, it also has two halves called hemispheres. You might have heard it said that some people are more left-brained while others are more right-brained. That's not just a saying. Caltech professor Roger Sperry won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for discovering it. In a nutshell, 1. The left hemisphere reasons sequentially, analyzes details, and excels at linear analysis. Left-brained or linear thinkers who are analytically strong are often called bright. 2. The right hemisphere thinks across categories, recognizes themes, and synthesizes the big picture. Right-brained or lateral thinkers with more street smarts are often called smart. Most people tend to get more of their instructions from one side than the other, and they have trouble understanding people who get theirs from the opposite side. Our experience has been that left-brained folks tend to see right-brained folks as spacey or abstract, while right-brained thinkers tend to find left-brained thinkers literal or narrow. I have seen wonderful results occur when people know where their own and others' inclinations lie, realize that both ways of thinking are invaluable, and assign responsibilities accordingly. G. Understand how much the brain can and cannot change. This brings us to an important question. Can we change? We can all learn new facts and skills, but can we also learn to change how we are inclined to think? The answer is a qualified yes. Brain plasticity is what allows your brain to change its soft wiring. For a long time, scientists believed that after a certain critical period in childhood, most of our brain's neurological connections were fixed and highly unlikely to change. But recent research has suggested that a wide variety of practices, from physical exercise to studying to meditation, can lead to physical and physiological changes in our brains that affect our abilities to think and form memories. In a study of Buddhist monks who had practiced more than 10,000 hours of meditation, researchers at the University of Wisconsin measured significantly higher levels of gamma waves in their brains. These waves are associated with perception and problem-solving. That doesn't mean the brain is infinitely flexible. If you have a preference for a certain way of thinking, you might be able to train yourself to operate another way and find that easier to do over time, but you're very unlikely to change your underlying preference. Likewise, you may be able to train yourself to be more creative, but if you're not naturally creative, there's likely a limit to what you can do. That is simply reality, so we all might as well accept it and learn how to deal with it. There are coping techniques that we can use. For example, the creative, disorganized person who is likely to lose track of time can develop the habit of using alarms. The person who isn't good at some type of thinking can train himself to rely on the thinking of others who are better at it. The best way to change is through doing mental exercises. As with physical exercise, this can be painful unless you enlist the habit loop discussed earlier to connect the rewards to the actions, rewiring your brain to love learning and beneficial change. Remember that accepting your weaknesses is contrary to the instincts of those parts of your brain that want to hold on to the illusion that you are perfect. Doing the things that will reduce your instinctual defensiveness takes practice and requires operating in an environment that reinforces open-mindedness. As you'll see when we get into work principles, I've developed a number of tools and techniques that help overcome that resistance individually and across organizations. Instead of expecting yourself or others to change, I found that it's often most effective to acknowledge one's weaknesses and create explicit guardrails against them. This is typically a faster and higher probability path to success. Principle 4.4. Find out what you and others are like. Because of the biases with which we are wired, our self-assessments and our assessments of others tend to be highly inaccurate. Psychometric assessments are much more reliable. They are important in helping explore how people think during the hiring process and throughout employment. Though psychometric assessments cannot fully replace speaking with people and looking at their backgrounds and histories, they are far more powerful than traditional interviewing and screening methods. If I had to choose between just the assessments or just traditional job interviews to get at what people are like, I would choose the assessments. Fortunately, we don't have to make that choice. The four main assessments we use are the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, MBTI, the Workplace Personality Inventory, the Team Dimensions Profile, and Stratified Systems Theory. But we are constantly experimenting, for example, with the Big Five, so our mix will certainly change. Whatever the mix, they all convey people's preferences for thinking and action. They also provide us with new attributes and terminologies that clarify and amplify those we had identified on our own. I'll be describing a few of them. These descriptions are based on my own experiences and learnings, which are in many ways different from the official descriptions used by the assessment companies. A. Introversion versus extroversion. Introverts focus on the inner world and get their energy from ideas, memories, and experiences, while extroverts are externally focused and get their energy from being with people. Introversion and extroversion are also linked to differences in communication styles. If you have a friend who loves to talk out ideas and even has trouble thinking through something if there isn't someone around to work it through with, he or she is likely an extrovert. Introverts will usually find such conversations painful, preferring to think privately and share only after they've worked things out on their own. I found that it is important to help each communicate in the way they feel most comfortable. For example, introverts often prefer communicating in writing, such as email, rather than speaking in group settings, and tend to be less open with their critical thoughts. B. Intuiting versus sensing. Some people see big pictures, forests, and others see details, trees. In the Myers-Briggs framework, these ways of seeing are best represented by the continuum from intuiting to sensing. You can get an idea of people's preferences by observing what they focus on. For example, when reading, a sensing person who focuses on details can be thrown off by typos such as there, T-H-E-R-E, instead of there, T-H-E-I-R. While intuitive thinkers won't even notice the mistake. That is because the intuitive thinker's attention is focused on the context first and the details second. Naturally, you'd rather have a sensing person than an intuitor preparing your legal documents, where every I must be properly dotted and every T crossed just so. C. Thinking versus feeling. Some people make decisions based on logical analysis of objective facts, considering all the known provable factors important to a given situation and using logic to determine the best course of action. This approach is an indicator of a preference for thinking and is how you'd hope your doctor thinks when he makes a diagnosis. Other people who prefer feeling focus on harmony between people. They are better suited to roles that require lots of empathy, interpersonal contact, and relationship building, for example, HR and customer service. Before we had assessments to identify these differences, conversations between T's and F's were really frustrating. Now we laugh as we bump up against our differences because we know what they are and can see them playing out in classic ways. D. Planning versus perceiving. Some people like to live in a planned, orderly way, and others prefer flexibility and spontaneity. Planners, or judgers in Myers-Briggs terms, like to focus on a plan and stick with it, while perceivers are prone to focus on what's happening around them and adapt to it. Perceivers work from the outside in. They see things happening and work backward to understand the cause and how to respond. They also see many possibilities that they compare and choose from, often so many that they are confused by them. In contrast, planners work from the inside out, first figuring out what they want to achieve and then how things should unfold. Planners and perceivers have trouble appreciating each other. Perceivers see new things and change direction often. This is discomforting to planners, who weigh precedent much more heavily in their decision-making and assume if it was done in a certain way before, it should be done in the same way again. Similarly, planners can discomfort perceivers by being seemingly rigid and slow to adapt. E. Creators versus refiners versus advancers versus executors versus flexors. By identifying talents and preferences that lead people to feel a particular way, you can place them in jobs at which they will likely excel. At Bridgewater, we use a test called the Team Dimensions Profile, TDP, to connect people with their preferred role. The five types identified by the TDP are creators, refiners, advancers, executors, and flexors. Creators generate new ideas and original concepts. They prefer unstructured and abstract activities and thrive on innovation and unconventional practices. Advancers communicate these new ideas and carry them forward. They relish feelings and relationships and manage the human factors. They are excellent at generating enthusiasm for work. Refiners challenge ideas. They analyze projects for flaws, then refine them with a focus on objectivity and analysis. They love facts and theories and working with a systematic approach. Executors can also be thought of as implementers. They ensure that important activities are carried out and goals accomplished. They are focused on details and the bottom line. Flexors are a combination of all four types. They can adapt their styles to fit certain needs and are able to look at a problem from a variety of perspectives. Triangulating what I learn from each test reinforces or raises questions about the pictures of people I'm forming in my head. For example, when people's MBTI results suggest a preference for S, focus on details, and J, planful, and they come out as executors on the team dimension assessment, there is a very good chance that they are more detail-focused than right-brained and imaginative, which means that they would likely fit better in jobs that have less ambiguity and more structure and clarity. F. Focusing on tasks versus focusing on goals. Some people are focused on daily tasks, while others are focused on their goals and how to achieve them. I've found these differences to be quite similar to the differences between people who are intuitive versus sensing. Those who tend to focus on goals and visualize best can see their big pictures over time, and are also more likely to make meaningful changes and anticipate future events. These goal-oriented people can step back from the day-to-day and reflect on what and how they're doing. They are the most suitable for creating new things, organizations, projects, etc., and managing organizations that have lots of change. They typically make the most visionary leaders because of their ability to take a broad view and see the whole picture. In contrast, those who tend to focus on daily tasks are better at managing things that don't change much or that require processes to be completed reliably. Task-oriented people tend to make incremental changes that reference what already exists. They are slower to depart from the status quo and more likely to be blindsided by sudden events. On the other hand, they are typically more reliable. Although it may seem that their focus is narrower than higher-level thinkers, the roles they play are no less critical. I would never have gotten this book out or accomplished hardly anything else worthwhile if I didn't work with people who are wonderful at taking care of details. G. WPI characteristics. Another assessment we use is the Workplace Personality Inventory, WPI, a test based on data from the U.S. Department of Labor. It anticipates behavior and predicts job fit and satisfaction, singling out certain key characteristics and qualities, including persistence, independence, stress tolerance, and analytical thinking. This test helps us understand what people value and how they will make trade-offs between their values. For example, someone with low achievement orientation and high concern for others might be unwilling to step on others' toes in order to accomplish their goals. Likewise, someone who is bad at rule following may be more likely to think independently. We have found that something like 25 to 50 attributes can pretty well describe what a person is like. Each one comes in varying degrees of strength, like color tones. If you know what they are and put them together correctly, they will paint a pretty complete picture of a person. Our objective is to use test results and other information to try to do just that. We prefer to do it in partnership with the person being looked at because it helps us be more accurate, and at the same time, it's very helpful to them to see themselves objectively. Certain attributes combine frequently to produce recognizable archetypes. If you think about it, you can probably come up with a handful of archetypal people you meet over and over again in life. The spacey and practical artist, the tidy perfectionist, the crusher who runs through brick walls to get things done, the visionary who pulls amazing big ideas seemingly out of the air. Over time, I came up with a list of others, including shaper, chirper, tweaker, and open-minded learner, as well as advancer, creator, cat herder, gossiper, loyal doer, wise judge, and others. To be clear, archetypes are less useful than the better fleshed-out pictures created through the assessments. They are not precise. They are more like simple caricatures, but they can be useful when it comes to assembling teams. Individual people will always be more complex than the archetypes that describe them, and they may well match up with more than one. For example, the spacey artist may or may not also be a perfectionist or may be a crusher, too. While I won't go over all of them, I will describe shapers, the one that best represents me, in some depth. H. Shapers are people who can go from visualization to actualization. I talked a lot about the people I call shapers in the first part of this audiobook. I use the word to mean someone who comes up with unique and valuable visions and builds them out beautifully, typically over the doubts of others. Shapers get both the big picture and the details right. To me, it seems that shaper equals visionary plus practical thinker plus determined. I've found that shapers tend to share attributes such as intense curiosity and a compulsive need to make sense of things, independent thinking that verges on rebelliousness, a need to dream big and unconventionally, a practicality and determination to push through all obstacles to achieve their goals, and a knowledge of their own and others' weaknesses and strengths so they can orchestrate teams to achieve them. Perhaps even more importantly, they can hold conflicting thoughts simultaneously and look at them from different angles. They typically love to knock things around with other really smart people and can easily navigate back and forth between the big picture and the granular details, counting both as equally important. People wired with enough of these ways of thinking that they can operate in the world as shapers are very rare. But they could never succeed without working with others who are more naturally suited for other things and whose ways of thinking and acting are also essential. Knowing how one is wired is a necessary first step on any life journey. It doesn't matter what you do with your life as long as you are doing what is consistent with your nature and your aspirations. Having spent time with some of the richest, most powerful, most admired people in the world, as well as some of the poorest, most disadvantaged people in the most obscure corners of the globe, I can assure you that beyond a basic level, there is no correlation between happiness levels and conventional markers of success. A carpenter who derives his deepest satisfaction from working with wood can easily have a life as good or better than the President of the United States. If you've learned anything from this audiobook, I hope it's that everyone has strengths and weaknesses, and everyone has an important role to play in life. Nature made everything and everyone for a purpose. The courage that's needed the most isn't the kind that drives you to prevail over others, but the kind that allows you to be true to your truest self, no matter what other people want you to be. Principle 4.5. Getting the right people in the right roles in support of your goal is the key to succeeding at whatever you choose to accomplish. Whether it's in your private life or your work life, it is best for you to work with others in such a way that each person is matched up with other complementary people to create the best mix of attributes for their tasks. A. Manage yourself and orchestrate others to get what you want. Your greatest challenge will be having your thoughtful higher-level you manage your emotional lower-level you. The best way to do that is to consciously develop habits that will make doing the things that are good for you habitual. In managing others, the analogy that comes to mind is a great orchestra. The person in charge is the shaper conductor who doesn't do, for example, doesn't play an instrument, though he or she knows a lot about instruments, as much as visualize the outcome and sees to it that each member of the orchestra helps achieve it. The conductor makes sure each member of the orchestra knows what he or she is good at and what they're not good at, and what their responsibilities are. Each must not only perform at their personal best, but work together so the orchestra becomes more than the sum of its parts. One of the conductor's hardest and most thankless jobs is getting rid of people who consistently don't play well individually or with others. Most importantly, the conductor ensures that the score is executed exactly as he or she hears it in his or her head. The music needs to sound this way, she says, and then she makes sure it does. Bass players, bring out the structure. Here are the connections, here's the spirit. Each section of the orchestra has its own leaders. The concertmaster, the first chairs, who also help bring out the composer's and the conductor's visions. Approaching things in this way has helped me a lot. For example, with the bond systemization project I mentioned earlier, having this new perspective allowed us to better see the gaps between what we had and what we needed. While Bob was a great intellectual partner to me in understanding the big picture problem we wanted to solve, he was much weaker at visualizing the process required to get us from where we were to the solution. He also wasn't surrounding himself with the right people. He tended to want to work with people who were like him, so his main deputy on the project was a great sparring partner for mapping out big ideas on a whiteboard, but a lousy one for fleshing out the who, what, and when needed to bring those ideas to life. This deputy tested as a flexer, meaning that he was great at going in whatever direction Bob wanted to, but lacked the clear, independent view needed to keep Bob on track. After a few rounds of not making progress, we used our new tools for understanding people and acted on them, pushing Bob to transition to a new deputy, who is especially skilled at navigating the levels between the big-picture ideas and the discrete, smaller projects required to bring them about. Comparing the new deputy's baseball card to the original deputy's, she excelled in independent and systematic thinking, which were essential for having a clear picture of what to do with Bob's big ideas. This new deputy brought on other layers of support, including a project manager who was less engaged with the concepts and much more focused on the details of specific tasks and deadlines. When we looked at the new team members' baseball cards, we could quickly see them lighting up in some of the areas around being planful, concrete, and driving things to completion, which were areas of weakness for Bob. With this new team in place, things really started to hum. It was only by looking hard at the complete Lego set required to achieve our goal, and then going out and finding the missing pieces, that we were able to do it. Bond systemization is just one of countless projects that have benefited from our frank and open approach to understanding what people are like. And to be clear, I have just scratched the surface of what there is to know about mental wiring. In the next chapter, I'll bring everything you've heard about up to now together and break down the essentials of decision-making. Some decisions you should make yourself, and some you should delegate to someone more believable. Using self-knowledge to know which are which is the key to success, no matter what it is you are trying to do.
Chapter 5. Learn how to make decisions effectively. As a professional decision maker, I've spent my life studying how to make decisions effectively, and have constantly looked for rules and systems that will improve my odds of being right and ending up with more of whatever it is I'm going after. One of the most important things I've come to understand is that most of the processes that go into everyday decision-making are subconscious and more complex than is widely understood. For example, think about how you choose and maintain a safe distance behind the car in front of you when you're driving. Now describe the process in enough detail that someone who has never driven a car before can do it as well as you can, or so that it can be programmed into the computer that controls an autonomous car. I bet you can't. Now think about the challenges of making all your decisions well, in a systematic, repeatable way, and then being able to describe the processes so clearly and so precisely that anyone else can make the same quality decisions under the same circumstances. That's what I aspire to do and have found it invaluable, even though highly imperfect. While there's no one best way to make decisions, there are some universal rules for good decision-making that Jeremy will now take you through.
Principle 5.1. Recognize that 1. The biggest threat to good decision-making is harmful emotions, and 2. Decision-making is a two-step process, first learning and then deciding. Learning must come before deciding. As explained in Chapter 1, your brain stores different types of learning in your subconscious, your rote memory bank, and your habits. But no matter how you acquire your knowledge or where you store it, what's most important is that you know what paints a true and rich picture of the realities that will affect your decision. That's why it always pays to be radically open-minded and seek out believable others as you do your learning. Many people have emotional trouble doing this and block the learning that could help them make better decisions. Remind yourself that it's never harmful to at least hear an opposing point of view. Deciding is the process of choosing which knowledge should be drawn upon, both the facts of this particular what is and your broader understanding of the cause-effect machinery that underlies it, and then weighing them to determine a course of action, the what to do about it. This involves playing different scenarios through time to visualize how to get an outcome consistent with what you want. To do this well, you need to weigh first-order consequences against second- and third-order consequences, and base your decisions not just on near-term results, but on results over time. Failing to consider second- and third-order consequences is the cause of a lot of painfully bad decisions, and it is especially deadly when the first inferior option confirms your own biases. Never seize on the first available option, no matter how good it seems, before you've asked questions and explored. To prevent myself from falling into this trap, I used to literally ask myself questions. Am I learning? Have I learned enough yet that it's time for deciding? After a while, you will just naturally and open-mindedly gather all the relevant info, but in doing so, you will have avoided the first pitfall of bad decision-making, which is to subconsciously make the decision first and then cherry-pick the data that supports it. But how does one learn well? Learning well. For me, getting an accurate picture of reality ultimately comes down to two things: being able to synthesize accurately and knowing how to navigate levels. Synthesis is the process of converting a lot of data into an accurate picture. The quality of your synthesis will determine the quality of your decision-making. This is why it always pays to triangulate your views with people who you know synthesize well. This raises your chances of having a good synthesis, even if you feel like you've already done it for yourself. No sensible person should reject a believable person's views without great fear of being wrong. To synthesize well, you must 1. Synthesize the situation at hand, 2. Synthesize the situation through time, and 3. Navigate levels effectively. Principle 5.2. Synthesize the situation at hand. Every day you are faced with an infinite number of things that come at you. Let's call them dots. To be effective, you need to be able to tell which dots are important and which dots are not. Some people go through life collecting all kinds of observations and opinions like pocket lint, instead of just keeping what they need. They have detail anxiety, worrying about unimportant things. Sometimes small things can be important. For example, that little rattle in your car's engine could just be a loose piece of plastic, or it could be a sign your timing belt is about to snap. The key is having the higher-level perspective to make fast and accurate judgments on what the real risks are without getting bogged down in details. Remember, A. One of the most important decisions you can make is who you ask questions of. Make sure they're fully informed and believable. Find out who is responsible for whatever you are seeking to understand, and then ask them. Listening to uninformed people is worse than having no answers at all. B. Don't believe everything you hear. Opinions are a dime a dozen, and nearly everyone will share theirs with you. Many will state them as if they are facts. Don't mistake opinions for facts. C. Everything looks bigger up close. In all aspects of life, what's happening today seems like a much bigger deal than it will appear in retrospect. That's why it helps to step back to gain perspective and sometimes defer a decision until some time passes. D. New is overvalued relative to great. For example, when choosing which movie to watch or what book to read, are you drawn to proven classics or the newest big thing? In my opinion, it is smarter to choose the great over the new. E. Don't over-squeeze dots. A dot is just one piece of data from one moment in time. Keep that in perspective as you synthesize. Just as you need to sort big from small and what's happening in the moment from overall patterns, you need to know how much learning you can get out of any one dot without overweighing it. Principle 5.3. Synthesize the situation through time. To see how the dots connect through time, you must collect, analyze, and sort different types of information, which isn't easy. People who are good at pulling out patterns of events are rare and essential, but as with most abilities, synthesizing through time is only partially innate. Even if you're not good at it, you can get better through practice. To work through an example of synthesizing through time, please refer to the PDF included with this audio program. And you'll increase your chances of succeeding at it if you follow the next principle. A. Keep in mind both the rates of change and the levels of things, and the relationships between them. When determining an acceptable rate of improvement for something, it is its level in relation to the rate of change that matters. I often see people lose sight of this. They say it's getting better without noticing how far below the bar it is and whether the rate of change will get it above the bar in an acceptable amount of time. If someone who has been getting grades of 30s and 40s on their tests raised their scores to 50s over the course of a few months, it would be accurate to say that they are getting better, but they would still be woefully inadequate. Everything important in your life needs to be on a trajectory to be above the bar and headed toward excellent at an appropriate pace. B. Be imprecise. Understand the concept of by and large and use approximations. Because our educational system is hung up on precision, the art of being good at approximations is insufficiently valued. This impedes conceptual thinking. For example, when asked to multiply 38 by 12, most people do it the slow and hard way rather than simply rounding 38 up to 40, rounding 12 down to 10, and quickly determining that the answer is about 400. By and large is the level at which you need to understand most things in order to make effective decisions. Whenever a big picture, by and large statement is made and someone replies not always, my instinctual reaction is that we are probably about to dive into the weeds. That is, into a discussion of the exceptions rather than the rule, and in the process we will lose sight of the rule. To help people at Bridgewater avoid this time waster, one of our just-out-of-college associates coined a saying I often repeat. When you ask someone whether something is true and they tell you that it's not totally true, it's probably by and large true. C. Remember the 80-20 rule and know what the key 20% is. The 80-20 rule states that you get 80% of the value out of something from 20% of the information or effort. It is also true that you're likely to exert 80% of your effort getting the final 20% of the value. Understanding this rule saves you from getting bogged down in unnecessary detail once you've gotten most of the learning you need to make a good decision. D. Be an imperfectionist. Perfectionists spend too much time on little differences at the margins at the expense of the important things. There are typically just 5 to 10 important factors to consider when making a decision. It is important to understand these really well, though the marginal gains of studying even the important things past a certain point are limited. Principle 5.4. Navigate levels effectively. Reality exists at different levels, and each of them gives you different but valuable perspectives. It's important to keep all of them in mind as you synthesize and make decisions, and to know how to navigate between them. Let's say you're looking at your hometown on Google Maps. Zoom in close enough to see the buildings, and you won't be able to see the region surrounding your town, which can tell you important things. Maybe your town sits next to a body of water. Zoom in too close, and you won't be able to tell if the shoreline is along a river, a lake, or an ocean. You need to know which level is appropriate to your decision. We are constantly seeing things at different levels and navigating between them. Whether we know it or not, whether we do it well or not, and whether our objects are physical things, ideas, or goals. For example, you can navigate levels to move from your values to what you do to realize them on a day-to-day basis. To see what that looks like, refer to the PDF included with this audio program. To observe how well you do this in your own life, pay attention to your conversations. We tend to move between levels when we talk. A. Use the terms above the line and below the line to establish which level a conversation is on. An above-the-line conversation addresses the main points and a below-the-line conversation focuses on the subpoints. When a line of reasoning is jumbled and confusing, it's often because the speaker has gotten caught up in the below-the-line details without connecting them back to the major points. An above-the-line discourse should progress in an orderly and accurate way to its conclusion, only going below the line when it's necessary to illustrate something about one of the major points. B. Remember that decisions need to be made at the appropriate level, but they should also be consistent across levels. For instance, if you want to have a healthy life, you shouldn't have 12 sausage links and a beer every day for breakfast. In other words, you need to constantly connect and reconcile the data you're gathering at different levels in order to draw a complete picture of what's going on. Like synthesizing in general, some people are naturally better at this than others. But anyone can learn to do this to one degree or another. To do it well, it's necessary to 1. Remember that multiple levels exist for all subjects. 2. Be aware on what level you're examining a given subject. 3. Consciously navigate levels rather than see subjects as undifferentiated piles of facts that can be browsed randomly. 4. Diagram the flow of your thought processes using the outline template shown in the PDF. When you do all this with radical open-mindedness, you will become more aware not just of what you're seeing, but what you're not seeing, and what others perhaps are. It's a little like when jazz musicians jam. Knowing what level you're on allows everyone to play in the same key. When you know your own way of seeing and are open to others' ways too, you can create good conceptual jazz together rather than just screech at each other. Now let's go up a level and examine deciding. Decide well. Using decision-making logic to produce the best long-term outcomes has become its own science, one that employs probabilities and statistics, game theory, and other tools. While many of these tools are helpful, the fundamentals of effective decision-making are relatively simple and timeless. In fact, they are genetically encoded in our brains to varying degrees. Watch animals in the wild and you'll see that they instinctively make expected value calculations to optimize the energy they expend to find food. Those that did this well prospered and passed on their genes through the process of natural selection. Those that did it poorly perished. While most humans who do this badly won't perish, they will certainly be penalized by the process of economic selection. As previously explained, there are two broad approaches to decision-making: evidence and logic-based, which comes from the higher-level brain, and subconscious emotion-based, which comes from the lower-level animal brain. Principle 5.5. Logic, reason, and common sense are your best tools for synthesizing reality and understanding what to do about it. Be wary of relying on anything else. Unfortunately, numerous tests by psychologists show that the majority of people follow the lower-level path most of the time, which leads to inferior decisions without their realizing it. As Carl Jung put it, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate. It's even more important that decision-making be evidence-based and logical when groups of people are working together. If it's not, the process will inevitably be dominated by the most powerful rather than the most insightful participants, which is not only unfair, but suboptimal. Successful organizations have cultures in which evidence-based decision-making is the norm rather than the exception. Principle 5.6. Make your decisions as expected value calculations. Think of every decision as a bet with a probability and a reward for being right and a probability and a penalty for being wrong. Normally, a winning decision is one with a positive expected value, meaning that the reward times its probability of occurring is greater than the penalty times its probability of occurring, with the best decision being the one with the highest expected value. Let's say the reward for being right is $100 and its probability is 60%. While the penalty for being wrong is also $100. If you multiply the reward by the probability of being right, you get $60. And if you multiply the penalty by the probability of being wrong, 40%, you get $40. If you subtract the penalty from the reward, the difference is the expected value, which in this case is positive $20. Once you understand expected value, you also understand that it's not always best to bet on what's most probable. For example, suppose something that has only a 1 in 5 chance, 20% of succeeding, will return 10 times, for example, $1,000, the amount that it will cost you if it fails, $100. Its expected value is positive $120, so it's probably a smart decision, even though the odds are against you, as long as you can also cover the loss. Play these probabilities over and over again, and they will surely give you winning results over time. Though we mostly don't carry out these calculations explicitly, we constantly make them intuitively. For example, when you decide to take an umbrella to the store even though there's just a 40% chance of rain, or you check your phone to confirm the direction somewhere even though you're almost certain you know the way, you're making expected value calculations. Sometimes it's smart to take a chance, even when the odds are overwhelmingly against you, if the cost of being wrong is negligible relative to the reward that comes with the slim chance of being right. As the saying goes, it never hurts to ask. This principle made a big difference in my own life. Years ago, when I was just starting my family, I saw a house that was perfect for us in every way. The problem was that it wasn't on the market, and everyone I asked told me the owner wasn't interested in selling. To make matters worse, I was pretty sure I would be turned down for an adequate mortgage. But I figured that it wouldn't cost me anything to call the owner to see if we could work something out. As it turned out, not only was he willing to sell, he was willing to give me a loan. The same principle applies when the downside is terrible. For example, even if the probability of your having cancer is low, it might pay to get yourself tested when you have a symptom just to make sure. To help you make expected value calculations well, remember that A. Raising the probability of being right is valuable no matter what your probability of being right already is. I often observe people making decisions if their odds of being right are greater than 50%. What they fail to see is how much better off they'd be if they raised their chances even more. You can almost always improve your odds of being right by doing things that will give you more information. The expected value gain from raising the probability of being right from 51% to 85%, that is by 34 percentage points, is 17 times more than raising the odds of being right from 49%, which is probably wrong, to 51%, which is only a little more likely to be right. Think of the probability as a measure of how often you're likely to be wrong. Raising the probability of being right by 34% means that a third of your bets will switch from losses to wins. That's why it pays to stress test your thinking, even when you're pretty sure you're right. B. Knowing when not to bet is as important as knowing what bets are probably worth making. You can significantly improve your track record if you only make the bets that you are most confident will pay off. C. The best choices are the ones that have more pros than cons, not those that don't have any cons at all. Watch out for people who argue against something whenever they can find something, anything, wrong with it, without properly weighing all the pluses and minuses. Such people tend to be poor decision makers. Principle 5.7. Prioritize by weighing the value of additional information against the cost of not deciding. Some decisions are best made after acquiring more information. Some are best made immediately. Just as you need to constantly sort the big from the small when you're synthesizing what's going on, you need to constantly evaluate the marginal benefit of gathering more information against the marginal cost of waiting to decide. People who prioritize well understand the following. A. All of your must-dos must be above the bar before you do your like-to-dos. Separate your must-dos from your like-to-dos and don't mistakenly slip any like-to-dos onto the first list. B. Chances are you won't have time to deal with the unimportant things, which is better than not having time to deal with the important things. I often hear people say, "Wouldn't it be good to do this or that?" It's likely they are being distracted from far more important things that need to be done well. C. Don't mistake possibilities for probabilities. Anything is possible. It's the probabilities that matter. Everything must be weighed in terms of their likelihoods and prioritized. People who can accurately sort probabilities from possibilities are generally strong at practical thinking. They're the opposite of the philosopher types who tend to get lost in the clouds of possibilities. Shortcuts for becoming a great decision maker. Great decision makers don't remember all of these steps in a rote way and carry them out mechanically, yet they do follow them. That's because through time and experience they've learned to do most of them reflexively, just as a baseball player catches a fly ball without thinking about how he's going to do it. If they had to call each of the principles up from their memory and then run them through their slow conscious minds, they couldn't possibly handle all the things that are coming at them well. But there are a couple of things that they do carry out consciously, and you should do them too. Principle 5.8. Simplify. Get rid of irrelevant details so that the essential things and the relationships between them stand out. As the saying goes, any damn fool can make it complex. It takes a genius to make it simple. Think of Picasso. He could paint beautiful representational paintings from an early age, but he continually pared down and simplified as his career progressed. Not everyone has a mind that works that way, but just because you can't do something naturally doesn't mean you can't do it. You just have to have creativity and determination. If necessary, you can seek the help of others. Principle 5.9. Use principles. Using principles is a way of both simplifying and improving your decision-making. While it might seem obvious to you by now, it's worth repeating that realizing that almost all cases at hand are just another one of those, identifying which one of those it is, and then applying well-thought-out principles for dealing with it. This will allow you to massively reduce the number of decisions you have to make. I estimate by a factor of something like 100,000, and will lead you to make much better ones. The key to doing this well is to 1. Slow down your thinking so you can note the criteria you are using to make your decision. 2. Write the criteria down as a principle. 3. Think about those criteria when you have an outcome to assess, and refine them before the next one of those comes along. Identifying which one of those each thing is like identifying which species an animal is. Doing that for each thing and then matching it up with the appropriate principles will become like playing a game, so it will be fun as well as helpful. Of course, it can also be challenging. Many cases at hand, as I call them, are hybrids. When a case at hand contains a few another ones of those, one must weigh different principles against each other using mental maps of how the different types of things I encounter should be handled. To help people do that, I created a tool called a coach, which is explained in the appendix. You can use your own principles or you can use others. You just want to use the best ones possible well. If you think that way constantly, you will become an excellent principled thinker. Principle 5.10. Believability weight your decision-making. I have found triangulating with highly believable people who are willing to have thoughtful disagreements has never failed to enhance my learning and sharpen the quality of my decision-making. It typically leads me to make better decisions than I could have otherwise, and it typically provides me with thrilling learning. I urge you to do it. To do it well, be sure to avoid the common perils of 1. Valuing your own believability more than is logical, and 2. Not distinguishing between who is more or less credible. In case of a disagreement with others, start by seeing if you can agree on the principles that should be used to make that decision. This discussion should include exploring the merits of the reasoning behind the different principles. If you agree on them, apply them to the case at hand, and you'll arrive at a conclusion everyone agrees on. If you disagree on the principles, try to work through your disagreement based on your respective believabilities. I will explain how we do this in more detail in Work Principles. This sort of principled and believability-weighted decision-making is fascinating and leads to much different and much better decision-making than is typical. For example, imagine if we use this approach to choose the president. It would be fascinating to see which principles we would come up with, both for determining what makes a good president, as well as for deciding who is most believable in making such determinations. Would we wind up with something like one person, one vote, or something different? And if different, in what ways? It certainly would lead to very different outcomes. During the next election, let's do this in parallel with our ordinary electoral process so we can see the difference. While believability-weighted decision-making can sound complicated, chances are you do it all the time, pretty much whenever you ask yourself, "Who should I listen to?" But it's almost certainly true that you'd do it a lot better if you gave more thought to it. Principle 5.11. Convert your principles into algorithms and have the computer make decisions alongside you. If you can do that, you will take the power of your decision-making to a whole other level. In many cases, you will be able to test how that principle would have worked in the past or in various situations that will help you refine it, and in all cases, it will allow you to compound your understanding to a degree that would otherwise be impossible. It will also take emotion out of the equation. Algorithms work just like words in describing what you would like to have done, but they are written in a language that the computer can understand. If you don't know how to speak this language, you should either learn it or have someone close to you who can translate it for you. Your children and their peers must learn to speak this language because it will soon be as important or more important than any other language. By developing a partnership with your computer alter ego in which you teach each other and each do what you do best, you will be much more powerful than if you went about your decision-making alone. The computer will also be your link to great collective decision-making, which is far more powerful than individual decision-making, and will almost certainly advance the evolution of our species. Systemized and computerized decision-making. In the future, artificial intelligence will have a profound impact on how we make decisions in every aspect of our lives, especially when combined with the new era of radical transparency about people that's already upon us. Right now, whether you like it or not, it is easy for anyone to access your digital data to learn a tremendous amount about what you're like, and this data can be fed into computers that do everything from predict what you're likely to buy to what you value in life. While this sounds scary to many people, at Bridgewater, we have been combining radical transparency with algorithmic decision-making for more than 30 years and have found that it produces remarkable results. In fact, I believe that it won't be long before this kind of computerized decision-making guides us nearly as much as our brains do now. The concept of artificial intelligence is not new. Even back in the 1970s, when I first started experimenting with computerized decision-making, it had already been around for nearly 20 years. The term artificial intelligence was first introduced in 1956 at a conference at Dartmouth College. While a lot has changed since then, the basic concepts remain the same. To give you just one ultra-simple example of how computerized decision-making works, let's say you have two principles for heating your home. You want to turn the heat on when the temperature falls below 68, and you want to turn the heat off between midnight and 5 a.m. You can express the relationship between these criteria in a simple decision-making formula. If the temperature is less than 68 degrees and the time is not between 5 a.m. and midnight, then turn on the heat. By gathering many such formulas, it's possible to create a decision-making system that takes in data, applies and weighs the relevant criteria, and recommends a decision. Specifying our investment decision-making criteria in algorithms and running historical data through them, or specifying our work principles and algorithms and using them to aid in management decision-making, are just bigger and more complicated versions of that smart thermostat. They allow us to make more informed and less emotional decisions much faster than we could on our own. I believe that people will increasingly do this, and that computer coding will become as essential as writing. In time, we will use machine assistants as much for decision-making as we do for information gathering today. As these machines help us, they will learn about what we are like, what we value, what our strengths and weaknesses are, and they will be able to tailor the advice they give us by automatically seeking out the help of others who are strong where we are weak. It won't be long before our machine assistants are speaking to others' machine assistants and collaborating in this way. In fact, that's beginning to happen already. Imagine a world in which you can use technology to connect to a system in which you can input the issue you're dealing with and have exchanges about what you should do and why with the highest-rated thinkers in the world. We'll soon be able to do this. Before too long, you will be able to tap the highest quality thinking on nearly every issue you face and get the guidance of a computerized system that weighs different points of view. For example, you will be able to ask what lifestyle or career you should choose given what you're like, or how to best interact with specific people based on what they're like. These innovations will help people get out of their own heads and unlock an incredibly powerful form of collective thinking. We are doing this now and have found it way better than traditional thinking. While this kind of view often leads to talk of artificial intelligence competing with human intelligence, in my opinion, human and artificial intelligence are far more likely to work together because that will produce the best results. It'll be decades and maybe never before the computer can replicate many of the things that the brain can do in terms of imagination, synthesis, and creativity. That's because the brain comes genetically programmed with millions of years of abilities honed through evolution. The science of decision-making that underlies many computer systems remains much less valuable than the art. People still make the most important decisions better than computers do. To see this, you need look no further than at the kinds of people who are uniquely successful. Software developers, mathematicians, and game theory modelers aren't running away with all the rewards. It is the people who have the most common sense, imagination, and determination. Only human intelligence can apply interpretations that are required to provide computer models with appropriate input. For example, a computer can't tell you how to weigh the value of the time you spend with your loved ones against the time you spend at work or the optimal mix of hours that will provide you with the best marginal utilities for each activity. Only you know what you value most, who you want to share your life with, what kind of environment you want to be in, and ultimately how to make the best choices to bring those things about. What's more, so much of our thinking comes from the subconscious in ways we don't understand that thinking we can model it fully is as unlikely as an animal that has never experienced abstract thinking attempting to define and replicate it. Yet at the same time, the brain cannot compete with the computer in many ways. Computers have much greater determination than any person as they will work 24/7 for you. They can process vastly more information and they can do it much faster, more reliably, and more objectively than you could ever hope to. They can bring millions of possibilities that you never thought of to your attention. Perhaps most important of all, they are immune to the biases and consensus-driven thinking of crowds. They don't care if what they see is unpopular, and they never panic. During those terrible days after 9/11 when the whole country was being whipsawed by emotion, or the weeks between September 19th and October 10th of 2008 when the Dow fell 3,600 points, there were times I felt like hugging our computers. They kept their cool no matter what. This combination of man and machine is wonderful. The process of man's mind working with technology is what elevates us. It's what has taken us from an economy where most people dig in the dirt to today's information age. It's for that reason that people who have common sense, imagination, and determination, who know what they value and what they want, and who also use computers, math, and game theory, are the best decision makers there are. At Bridgewater, we use our systems much as a driver uses a GPS in a car. Not to substitute for our navigational abilities, but to supplement them. Principle 5.12. Be cautious about trusting AI without having deep understanding. I worry about the dangers of AI in cases where users accept or, worse, act upon the cause-effect relationships presumed in algorithms produced by machine learning without understanding them deeply. Before I explain why, I want to clarify my terms. Artificial intelligence and machine learning are words that are thrown around casually and often used as synonyms, even though they are quite different. I categorize what is going on in the world of computer-aided decision-making under three broad types: expert systems, mimicking, and data mining. These categories are mine and not the ones in common use in the technology world. Expert systems are what we use at Bridgewater, where designers specify criteria based on their logical understandings of a set of cause-effect relationships and then see how different scenarios would emerge under different circumstances. But computers can also observe patterns and apply them in their decision-making without having any understanding of the logic behind them. I call such an approach mimicking. This can be effective when the same things happen reliably over and over again and are not subject to change, such as in a game bounded by hard and fast rules. But in the real world, things do change, so a system can easily fall out of sync with reality. The main thrust of machine learning in recent years has gone in the direction of data mining, in which powerful computers ingest massive amounts of data and look for patterns. While this approach is popular, it's risky in cases when the future might be different from the past. Investment systems built on machine learning that is not accompanied by deep understanding are dangerous, because when some decision rule is widely believed, it becomes widely used, which affects the price. In other words, the value of a widely known insight disappears over time. Without deep understanding, you won't know if what happened in the past is genuinely of value, and even if it was, you will not be able to know whether or not its value has disappeared, or worse. It's common for some decision rules to become so popular that they push the price far enough that it becomes smarter to do the opposite. Remember that computers have no common sense. For example, a computer could easily misconstrue the fact that people wake up in the morning and then eat breakfast to indicate that waking up makes people hungry. I'd rather have fewer bets, ideally uncorrelated ones, in which I am highly confident, than more bets I'm less confident in, and would consider it intolerable if I couldn't argue the logic behind any of my decisions. A lot of people vest their blind faith in machine learning because they find it much easier than developing deep understanding. For me, that deep understanding is essential, especially for what I do. I don't mean to imply that these mimicking or data mining systems, as I call them, are useless. In fact, I believe that they can be extremely useful in making decisions in which the future range and configuration of events are the same as they've been in the past. Given enough computing power, all possible variables can be taken into consideration. For example, by analyzing data about the moves that great chess players have made under certain circumstances, or the procedures great surgeons have used during certain types of operations, valuable programs can be created for chess playing or surgery. Back in 1997, the computer program Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov, the world's highest-ranked chess player, using just this approach. But this approach fails in cases where the future is different from the past, and you don't know the cause-effect relationships well enough to recognize them all. Understanding these relationships as I do has saved me from making mistakes when others did, most obviously in the 2008 financial crisis. Nearly everyone else assumed that the future would be similar to the past. Focusing strictly on the logical cause-effect relationships was what allowed us to see what was really going on. When you get down to it, our brains are essentially computers that are programmed in certain ways, take in data, and spit out instructions. We can program the logic in both the computer that is our mind and the computer that is our tool so that they can work together and even double-check each other. And doing that is fabulous. For example, suppose we were trying to derive the universal laws that explain species change over time. Theoretically, with enough processing power and time, this should be possible. We would need to make sense of the formulas the computer produces, of course, to make sure that they are not data mined gibberish, by which I mean based on correlations that are not causal in any way. We would do this by constantly simplifying these rules until their elegance is unmistakable. Of course, given our brain's limited capacity and processing speed, it could take us forever to achieve a rich understanding of all the variables that go into evolution. Is all the simplifying and understanding that we employ in our expert systems truly required? Maybe not. There is certainly a risk that changes not in the tested data might still occur. But one might argue that if our data mining-based formulas seem able to account for the evolution of all species through all time, then the risks of relying on them for just the next 10, 20, or 50 years is relatively low compared to the benefits of having a formula that appears to work but is not fully understandable, and that at the very least might prove useful in helping scientists cure genetic diseases. In fact, we may be too hung up on understanding. Conscious thinking is only one part of understanding. Maybe it's enough that we derive a formula for change and use it to anticipate what is yet to come. I myself find the excitement, lower risk, and educational value of achieving a deep understanding of cause-effect relationships much more appealing than a reliance on algorithms I don't understand, so I am drawn to that path. But is it my lower-level preferences and habits that are pulling me in this direction, or is it my logic and reason? I'm not sure. I look forward to probing the best minds in artificial intelligence on this and having them probe me. Most likely our competitive natures will compel us to place bigger and bigger bets on relationships computers find that are beyond our understanding. Some of those bets will pay off while others will backfire. I suspect that AI will lead to incredibly fast and remarkable advances, but I also fear that it could lead to our demise. We are headed for an exciting and perilous new world. That's our reality. And as always, I believe that we are much better off preparing to deal with it than wishing it weren't true.
Life principles, putting it all together. In order to have the best life possible, you have to know what the best decisions are and have the courage to make them. In Life Principles, I've explained some principles that help me do both of these things. I believe that because the same kinds of things happen over and over again, a relatively few well-thought-out principles will allow you to deal with just about anything that reality throws at you. Where you get these principles from doesn't matter as much as having them and using them consistently. and that you never stop refining and improving them. To acquire principles that work, it's essential that you embrace reality and deal with it well. Don't fall into the common trap of wishing that reality worked differently than it does, or that your own realities were different. Instead, embrace your realities and deal with them effectively. After all, making the most of your circumstances is what life is all about. This includes being transparent with your thoughts and open-mindedly accepting the feedback of others. Doing it will dramatically increase your learning. Along your journey, you will inevitably experience painful failures. It's important to realize that they can either be the impetus that fuels your personal evolution, or they can ruin you depending on how you react to them. I believe that evolution is the greatest force in the universe and that we all evolve in basically the same way. Conceptually, it looks like a series of loops that either lead upward toward constant improvement or remain flat or trend downward toward ruin. You will determine what your loops look like. Your evolutionary process can be described as a five-step process for getting what you want. It consists of setting your goals, identifying and not tolerating problems, diagnosing problems, coming up with designs to get around them, and then doing the tasks required. The important thing to remember is that no one can do all of those steps well alone, but it's possible to do them with the help of others. Different people with different abilities working together create the most powerful machines to produce achievements. If you're willing to confront reality, accept the pain that comes with that, and follow the five-step process to drive yourself toward your goals, you're on the path to success. Yet most people fail to do this because they hold on to bad opinions that could easily be rectified by going above themselves to objectively look down on their situations and weigh what they and others think about it. It's for that reason I believe that you must be radically open-minded. Our biggest barriers for doing this well are our ego barrier and our blindness barrier. The ego barrier is our innate desire to be capable and have others recognize us as such. The blindness barrier is the result of our seeing things through our own subjective lenses. Both barriers can prevent us from seeing how things really are. The most important antidote for them is radical open-mindedness, which is motivated by the genuine worry that one might not be seeing one's choices optimally. Radical open-mindedness is the ability to effectively explore different points of view and different possibilities without letting your ego or blind spots get in your way. Doing this well requires practicing thoughtful disagreement, which is the process of seeking out brilliant people who disagree with you in order to see things through their eyes and gain a deeper understanding. Doing this well will raise your probability of making good decisions and will also give you a fabulous education. If you can learn radical open-mindedness and practice thoughtful disagreement, you'll radically increase your learning. Finally, being radically open-minded requires you to have an accurate self-assessment of your own and others' strengths and weaknesses. This is where understanding something about how the brain works and the different psychometric assessments that can help you discover what your brain is like comes in. To get the best results out of yourself and others, you must understand that people are wired very differently. In a nutshell, learning how to make decisions the best possible way and learning how to have the courage to make them comes from going after what you want, failing and reflecting well through radical open-mindedness, and changing, evolving to become ever more capable and less fearful. In the final chapter of this section, Learn How to Make Decisions Effectively, I shared some more granular principles for how to do all of the above and weigh your options in specific situations to determine the right path to follow. You can, of course, do all of these things alone, but if you understood anything about the concepts of radical open-mindedness, it should be obvious that going it alone will only take you so far. We all need others to help us triangulate and get at the best possible decisions. and to help us see our weaknesses objectively and compensate for them. More than anything else, your life is affected by the people around you and how you interact with each other. Your ability to get what you want when working with others who want the same things is much greater than your ability to get those things by yourself. Yet we haven't talked about how groups should operate to be most effective. That's what we'll do in Work Principles. Work Principles is about people working together. Because the power of a group is so much greater than the power of an individual, the principles that follow are likely even more important than the ones we've covered up until this point. In fact, I wrote them first and then wrote Life Principles in order to help others make sense of the approach I was implicitly applying running Bridgewater.